Well, hello everyone out there in the sports business and sports marketing world, and welcome to another episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. As always, I am your trusty host, Neil Horwitz. You can find more information on the podcast at dsmsports.net and follow me on Twitter at njh287. Really psyched about today's show. We have a bit of a celebrity in the ranks that we're going to be speaking to today. His name is Andrew Brandt. You may know him. He has a pretty wide presence across Twitter, across ESPN's various outlets, writes for the MMQB.com, and is also an educator with Villanova University and the Wharton School of Business. But he's also someone who can lend a unique perspective, having served on the team side of business in the NFL as an agent, and now as well as an observer and educator in the media side. But before we get to our conversation with Andrew Brandt, we have this episode's helpful tool. And this episode's helpful tool is, well, LinkedIn. Mainly your LinkedIn company page and the analytics to go with it that you may not be getting the most out of. LinkedIn to me is often left as a redheaded stepchild, so to speak, where teams, brands, leagues are not actively publishing content there, even as the platform is pushing more content out in the form of blog posts and company updates. Give it a shot. Try publishing some content. You'll be surprised at the engagement levels and the reach that you get. I can tell you just from third-party observation from pages that I've managed that oftentimes reach and engagement can go beyond 100%, 200% of a company's following. So think about that. As opposed to Facebook, where you're seeing around 6 to 10% of your total reach, on LinkedIn, you could be getting anywhere from 200 to 300%, if not more. Also, take a look at your analytics on your LinkedIn page. It can be very informative as to who is searching for you, who is looking at your page, and who is following your company page. You can get an idea not just of views per day, engagement per day, how reach is changing over time, but also who exactly is engaging with your page and looking at your page. Are they senior level people? Are they entry level people? What industries are they coming from? How does it compare to other peers in the field in a similar line of work? How does your number of following compare to them, your reach compared to them? Also get a quick look at your unique visitors and your page views per day and see how that has trended over time. Has there been an event or a news release or a new product that you put out there recently that has caused a lot more views of your page? And are you maximizing those views by providing content, whether that's in the form of content marketing that might push your product a little bit more, or just something that's going to really serve your fan base and have them coming back to your company page for future content and to start that lead generation process, that sales funnel, and that building relationship of trust between yourself and your client, whether that's a fan, a corporate partner, or whoever else, or a future employee. So that's this episode's helpful tool. I could wax poetic about it all day, but really, if you're managing a LinkedIn page, stop right now and take a look at your analytics. Try publishing, whether it's a unique piece of news content you think is ripe for a professional audience, or just a normal piece of news that you'd be putting up on your Facebook page or your Google Plus page, and see how much traction it can get. Start using that LinkedIn page and those analytics to the fullest extent today. And you'll see some results, I think. At least learn something. All right, that's this episode's helpful tool. It's called LinkedIn, as you know. But are you using your company page and your company page's analytics to get the full value from LinkedIn? We'll be right back with a great conversation I had the privilege of having with ESPN NFL business analyst and, well, a lot of titles that you're about to hear again as we talk to Andrew Brandt right after this. All right, welcome back to the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Really delighted for our guest today, really excited to speak to him. A wealth of knowledge about sports business, especially in football, and really decorated background. But let's welcome into the podcast Andrew Brandt. You might know him. He's a Sports Illustrated columnist, ESPN NFL business analyst, lecturer at the Wharton School of Business at UPenn, and director of sports law at Villanova. Very impressive background, and welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
Good to be with you, Neil.
Well, Andrew, I don't know how you keep up with all that stuff. I don't know how there's enough time in the day, but you've obviously become quite a figure in the sports business world going back several years. Before we get into the meat of our conversation today, which I'm really excited to share with our listeners. Give our listeners a quick idea of your background, how you came up in the field, and any tips along the way.
Yeah, I mean, what I try to be right now, sort of starting now and then going backwards, is someone that can lend insights and information and perspective, having been on both sides of the ball, and those both sides meaning the player side as an agent two different times with two different companies. I was an agent primarily football, but also basketball, a little bit of baseball, and then on the team side, first with the Barcelona Dragons of the NFL's World League and then with the Packers for 9 years. So having seen both sides of it, you know, my life now is more, I guess I'd like to say in a charitable way, giving back, although certainly not curing cancer or anything like that. I don't want to sound like this is such a good Samaritan thing I'm doing, but what I try to do is use my knowledge and insights in a way that more people can understand things, whether it's through talking on ESPN or writing for the MMQB or Sports Illustrated or teaching at Penn or Villanova Law School, trying to sort of impart that to a whole, I guess, generation of people. And I've found that more people are interested in this stuff than even when I started doing this a few years ago. There just seems to be an appetite for the business of sports, for the law of sports, for deeper issues. And I try to take people behind that curtain. You know, briefly, I came out of Stanford and didn't know what else to do, knew I wanted to be in sports, had a sports background as a tennis player, although certainly not elite level, and then went to law school. And I am from Washington, D.C. I came back home and went to Georgetown Law School. And luckily for me, there was a big firm in D.C. called ProServe at the time, represented a lot of athletes, a lot of tennis players, and I knew the leaders of the firm from the world of tennis, just from playing junior tournaments. And they gave me a shot. Basically, I kind of said, hey, maybe I can get you interviews with Stanford tennis players, the best program in the country. Maybe I can help that way. And basically, they gave me a shot. And I spent a lot of time in law school interning there. And then after law school, was able to parlay it into a real job. And I know so many young people ask, how do you get in? And you go to law school, you go to business school, you go to sports management school. How do you get an internship? And I wish there was a formula. There was something I could just say to all the requests and emails and Twitters that I get and just put it out there. But people don't want to hear right place, right time, but so much of it is. And I just got into it because I was able to use whatever I had, which was maybe going to Stanford, knowing tennis players, and I got in. And then I worked for a guy named David Falk, who was the super basketball agent with Michael Jordan and Patrick Ewing, Alonzo Mourning, Allen Iverson. And I was lucky enough to get under him, but he was a good thing for me. He was so consumed with basketball that I was able to develop a football practice and had a bunch of guys and sort of developed using the name of the firm and using Michael Jordan as a selling point, and was about 5 years working under David when the NFL called. It's the first time, as you'll see, I made a couple switches. And basically, they wanted me to come and be one of the general managers of this new league overseas, the Barcelona Dragons. And long story short, I decided to do it. It was quite an experience. Nothing really to train me for that. It was right away, had to hire a coach, had to get players, had to build a staff, had to go to a country that didn't know anything about American football. So it was quite an experience, and you get there, and so many stories from Barcelona, but the funniest one was our first touchdown was a beautiful seam pattern to our tight end. He broke three tackles, 70-yard touchdown, and there's polite golf applause. Then our kicker comes on and kicks the extra point, and they go nuts.
Oh, that's classic.
It was just the soccer mentality. It's interesting, as we hear on the World Cup. It's just so ingrained that the football was just so foreign to them. Anyway, that league folded after a year and a half, and it's since came back as NFL Europe, which folded again. But I went back to the agent business, working this time for a pioneer in the industry called Bob Wolf Associates. Bob Wolf had died. His firm was sold to a conglomerate group in Boston, and they hired people to run divisions. I ran the football basketball division and lived in Boston and was prepared to do that for quite some time. And at that time, I had a client named Ricky Williams. Long story short, he had developed into the top player in the country, won the Heisman, all that stuff. But eventually left me for Master P, who was a rapper that he just wanted a different experience as an agent, someone that could take him into the music and entertainment industry. So having lost Ricky Williams...
Something's a little relevant today, too, with Jay-Z coming up in the ranks.
Indeed it is, and I'm asked about that a lot, and I'll talk about that a little later. But I do think it was really a point in the road for me, because... faced with this, I didn't know what to do, but it was just the timing of it where the Green Bay Packers were calling. And I had a player there who was a third-string quarterback at the time named Matt Hasselbeck, but he didn't need a contract, and I ignored the calls. But I finally called him back, and I said, I can't talk about Hasselbeck right now. I got Ricky Williams. I got Master P. And anyway, they said it wasn't about Hasselbeck, that Mike Holmgren had gone to the Seattle Seahawks, taken the top business guy with him, and they wanted me to switch sides. So came to Green Bay, interviewed, was very direct. I said, listen, can I ask you a question? If I take this job, do I actually have to move here? And they said, no offense taken, but yes. And it just became a lifestyle experience where I, back to my wife, at that time we had just one son, a baby, and we decided to get off the train of chasing these college players around and go to the other side and move to Green Bay, Wisconsin, a place I had to look up on a map. And, you know, in a nutshell, my 9.5 years in Green Bay, I was the person in the middle, I guess, in the middle of the football side and the business side. The business side looks long-term. How are we looking out 3 years? What's our cash? What's our cap? What's our plan when Brett retires? Those kind of things. And on the football side, very immediate, when can I sign this guy? Can I get him on the team now? Those kind of things. Sometimes I was the voice of aggression to the business side, saying, hey, we should do this, let's spend another million. And sometimes I was the voice of caution to the football side, like, hey, we've got enough money invested in D-line or whatever it is, let's take a break here. So 9 years with the Packers, and we hosted the Giants in the 2008 championship game, and it was a time where my wife and family and I decided, you know, we wanted to get back east, and after that we left. Came back to Philly, where my wife is from. She got to pick after being in rural Wisconsin for 9 years, and I've sort of created this life that I started this answer about, which is teaching, writing, talking, broadcasting, about, I think it's deeper than the business of football. I just think it's issues behind the game, inside the game, that, as I said, a growing audience wants to hear about.
Oh, very much so. And there's a ton of questions I have off of that great story, which I appreciate you telling. But was there a lot of precedent for what you had done, in as much as transitioning from the agent side to the team side and back and forth? Or were you kind of a, for lack of a better term, pioneer in that way?
Yeah, it's a good question. As people know now, the general manager of the Washington Redskins is a guy named Bruce Allen. Mm-hmm. His father is a legendary coach, George Allen, his brother in Congress, George Allen Jr. Bruce was probably the first. Bruce was an agent many years coming up before I did, and then went to, I believe, the Arizona Cardinals, but many years with the Raiders, and then many years with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and now with the Redskins. So I guess he was the first, but I think after I happened, there were several others kind of right away. A guy in New England that came from the agent business, a guy named Cliff Stein, who was an agent who's now at the Bears and has been there. He came soon after I did, so he probably came in like 2001. So he's probably been there 13 years, and he's still there. So there have been a few since that time, yes.
What do you think it was about you in particular that attracted the Packers to you as well. I mean, you were had an agent background. You had the background in Barcelona as well. What do you think allowed you to ascend in the industry besides, like you said, sort of being in the right place at the right time as well?
Yeah, I asked Ron Wolf, who was the GM at the time, I asked, why me? You know, you got a lot of agents out there. And one thing with Hasselbeck, who, has got to be at the top of my list for favorite people to work with, he was pursued by a lot of teams. And I just thought, with Andy Reid there as quarterback coach, with Brett there, with Holmgren there, I just thought he should stay. And as an agent, I really worked with the team on that and actually got some really good money for a young guy to just stay there. And I think they appreciated that. I think they found me easy to work with. They thought I knew my way around the CBA, and they thought that I had a good way of dealing with people. And they wanted to get a little more agent-friendly, too, and what better way than to hire an agent.
Very true. So in your position with the Packers in particular, and having to deal with questions of bringing players, having players not signed or cut, having to deal with cap restrictions, and really in this last decade, really, there's been a lot more transparency, it feels like, with how much the common fan knows about player movement, knows about caps, knows about amounts of money being spent, especially with social media making it so much more quick and transparent and bloggers able to get in. Have you seen that evolution, and did it start to really hit you when you were with the Packers? Were there more questions, columns being written, capologists in the media even, who were analyzing these questions and speculating about what you should or shouldn't be doing as a business guy for a sports team?
Not a lot, but I do think, you know, being in a market like Green Bay, we were so scrutinized. We probably got it more than most teams. I mean, we had media from Green Bay, from Milwaukee, from Madison, from all over the state, and they had to write about something every day. And many times they would come to me and sort of I would try to, in some ways, educate, not give away any state secrets, but talk to the media about these kind of things. And it was interesting for me to learn from them, the media, which I guess I am now, about the way they cover the game and how the one thing I've heard from media people since I started doing what I'm doing now is that, wow, you know, that's what we needed. We needed a resource to explain this stuff. And you're not really going to get that from someone on the inside because everybody's concerned about confidentiality and not exposing things that they're doing, not only because they want to keep them in-house, but they don't want other teams to read about them. So it's really developed, I think, partly because of me, but partly just because of this appetite that people have now.
And have you found, is the understanding, especially on the media side, is it getting to the point where there is a little more fluency, where you're not getting asked the same questions over and over again? Does there seem to be that education is working?
I think so. I mean, I think, the one thing I felt when I started doing this was a lot of beat writers were kind of using me as an answer man. They call me and say, hey, I'm writing this. Is this right? Is this okay? And I get calls from ESPN a lot about, hey, we're reporting this. Is this the right way to say it? And that's happened at Sports Illustrated too. And I am totally okay with that, being a resource for saying it the right way, because frankly, sometimes you see it and things are reported wrong about contracts, about labor issues, about business issues, not only in football, but all sports.
This is a bit of a broad question to that end. Is it a good thing for fans, for media, that there is a lot more understanding and transparency out there now about cap casualties, about what contracts really mean and what guaranteed money really means versus a number thrown out? Is it from a player side, from a business side, from a team and agent side, is it good?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question because, of course, I think it is. I'm trying to think from any other side, would it not be? I think, you know, teams know this stuff gets out. I think we're sort of beyond the days where you can control it. it has to be reported to the league. It has to be reported to the union. Agents have contacts all over the media. Agents let out numbers. Unions got contacts. League puts out numbers. The league has its own entity, NFL Media, and they'll put out things about things in team contracts or business. So I think it's better that it's transparent. And transparent is one thing. With these kind of issues, you need someone in the media to break it down. Because, again, you see these numbers, and they're not, usually not what they appear to be.
Right. Let's quickly then talk about, I know we're in the few minutes we have left here, when it does come to announcing a contract or announcing a player transaction, I mean, back in the old days, quote unquote, you put out a press release, it goes out maybe in the next day's newspaper. Now it's so instantaneous, you have almost all news, it seems like, is leaked ahead of time. Is there any effort, you believe, on the business side for teams to try to control the pace of that news, especially when it comes to players reporting it themselves or agents reporting whether it's a contract or an injury or even a trade?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's just a tide that's really going to be hard to stop, and it's only going to get worse. You know, one of the things I did when I moved back to Philly, the Eagles called, and I didn't want to go back to work for a team full-time, but I worked there as a consultant. And I just remember during a draft, I think 2009, when I came back, we traded a player, Ellis Hobbs, I believe, to the Patriots during the draft for like a fifth-round pick or fourth-round pick. And I remember just hearing the PR people saying, should we announce this? And then someone walked in and said, well, the Patriots just tweeted it. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my first exposure to Twitter. I'm like, wow. And I thought the Patriots were certainly an earlier adapter to be doing that. And you
as shocking as that is, too, huh?
Yeah, you wouldn't think they would be the team to do it. So you realize how instantaneous it is. Even 5 years ago, just you didn't expect these things to be out. So the one thing I've noticed is, for instance, when a contract's announced, fans are left hanging if they don't get numbers. It's like you can say, so-and-so just signed this player. That's not good enough. You know, that's not good enough for fans. They have to know details. They have to know what's going on with the contract, how long, how much money, how much real money. And then they want more from people like me to actually analyze it for them. So, you know, I think stories now, you know, there's only 20 weeks of games in the NFL, and that leaves 32 weeks for other stuff, and my focus is the other stuff.
Hey, that the demand for information that you spoke to is definitely as strong as ever. And then lastly, I did want to touch on sort of the notion of players that may not have superstar ability but are social media superstars. I mean, the NFL is maybe a little less prevalent than other sports, but you even have, like, going to the Packers, a TJ Lang, who has had some of the most retweeted tweets of all time and has built himself a little bit of a Twitter following. But around the league, even, you have guys who aren't quite your Richard Sherman levels but are still creating a big buzz and have a large following on social media, perhaps more than their play merits. Is that something you're noticing? Is that something that a team would take into account when evaluating what a player's worth is, or even the potential conflict a player could bring to a team?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know in terms of the first part where you think about a guy and how much following he has and what interest level there is in his social media presence. I think teams, from my point of view, are all about talent and character and evaluation and is he quote-unquote good enough? Does he fit our team? I think the other part is the sort of maintenance issues, and that's where a questionable Twitter, questionable social media presence, saying things that are offline or not good or politically incorrect, whatever it is, that's where I worry about players with teams, because the bottom line in the business of sports, I always say, is so many players, so few jobs. And if there's a reason a team feels like, you know, compared to the guy, other guy, they're about the same, but, you know, this one guy, he's a little higher maintenance, whether it's social media or whether it's something off the field, or he's just has a problem now and then, and they'll move on. So teams will move on, and if you give them reasons to, and you're not a star player, that can be troubling.
Do you think even agents are tracking players that are using social media and even trying to figure out who might be looking for a new representation, or there might be a good time to pounce on somebody?
I think in some ways they're looking at that, you know, and I think you can get a lot of clues from social media. I think one thing that was interesting is the beginning of free agency this year on March 12th. Everybody's looking for who's going to sign who, and I think you saw, like, Brandon Albert, the Kansas City Chiefs tackle that was a top name in free agency. You sort of saw, oh, as of today, he's following a lot of Miami Dolphins. Sure enough, he signed with the Dolphins. I think people look at those things for clues, because you can see when people followed who. So it's really a whole new universe.
Ah, very interesting. All righty, well, we could really pick Andrew's brain all day, but he's a busy man, so we'll be right back with our Ask Andrew segment with some quick-hitting questions. Have a little fun, Andrew, before he gets out of here. Great conversation with Andrew Brandt. Could really pick his brain all day about a number of subjects, because he offers such a unique perspective, and as you can tell, there's a reason why he's gone into education and working with schools recently, because he has the ability to articulate some pretty complex things and break it down into simple language that will anyone can understand, from an agent to an NFL team business operations personnel to just a casual fan. But we'll be right back with more with our Ask Andrew segment. We'll have a little fun with Andrew Brandt, get to know him a little bit more. But first, let's get this episode's shareable stat. And this episode's shareable stat is, well, it's kind of a unique one that comes via my buddy who helps run social media for the Buffalo Sabres of the NHL. He did a little personal study and found that 100% of the top NFL draft picks in this upcoming NFL draft, which happens June 27th and 28th, so it may have already happened by the time you're listening, but 100% of the top-ranked future draft picks are all on Twitter. Now, I'm sure that has changed over the last 10, 15, 20 years, let alone looking at some of the other leagues as well, and will continue to evolve in the future. The fact is that athletes more and more are not jumping on Twitter because it's an information tool, but it's a way to connect with fans and to start building your personal brand, especially in hockey, well, really across any amateur sport where you have potential to become a professional star. Athletes are starting to realize the power of the personal branding that Twitter can allow. A lot of these guys are playing at junior league levels in the OHL and the USHL and are becoming miniature stars in their own right before they hit the professional ranks, whereas others are becoming well-known through college or just through their local and travel team exploits and are joining up on Twitter to connect with fans, connect with others against whom they're playing, and to really just start, like I said, building the personal brand and getting their name out there, not just for their draft prospects, but for potential prospects with an agent or with brands as well. Really comes into line with what I talked to with Andrew today a little bit about athletes really starting to take charge of their brand and realizing the value that they have as an individual on social media. You may see this number change in the future, not so much 100% about being on Twitter, but you might see other platforms emerge as the generations come up through the ranks. Will it be Snapchat that is taking off soon? Will Facebook have a revival? Will we be talking about NHL draft picks on WhatsApp and how they're utilizing that to spread content on behalf of brands or partners or even just themselves? So really something to watch, but really informative and telling that 100% of this year's NHL draftees are on Twitter. So that's this episode's shareable stat. Think about it, analyze it, share it, and we'll be right back with Andrew Brandt in our Ask Andrew segment. I think you're going to have fun listening to his answers for these. All right, back with Andrew Brandt. Great segment we had with him previously. Now we're going to have a little fun. He survived his main interview. And now, Mr. Brandt, are you ready to ask Andrew?
I am.
All right, this one is should be interesting. The question you get asked the most by fans is what?
How much do practice squad players make?
And what's the answer?
It's about $6,000 a week.
If only you had $6,000 every time someone asked you that question, huh?
Yeah, I know.
Number two, and I've always really been curious about this for the Twitter superstars out there, yourself being among them. How many mentions do you estimate you get on an average day during the NFL season? Is your phone just exploding all day?
Mentions? Gosh, it's hard to know. It just depends if there's something that I put out that has a nugget that other people don't. I mean, it could be hundreds, but I would think usually probably 50 to 100.
Jeez. I don't know how you manage all that, let alone try to look at all of it. All right, this one is interesting as well, especially in your position now as an educator. The one thing that you wish fans and or media understood better about the way team business operations work?
The total number on NFL contracts is meaningless. It's just a number on the page. The only true value is the guarantee, and even that can be inflated based on the fact that guarantees are stair-stepped now in the NFL, meaning that you may have X guaranteed first year and you don't reach the second year until the season actually begins. So the reporting of NFL contracts is very erroneous on most of them.
And I'm sure as a former agent yourself, you know how to spin it the best way to present to a client, present to the public, present to the team as well.
Agents used to say to me, hey, Andrew, can I spin this as a $40 million contract or whatever? And I used to say, fine, if that's what helps close the deal, that was fine with me. But we knew what the real numbers were.
Oh, it's so true. All right, well, here's a quick and fun one. You probably spend a little bit of time up at Bristol headquarters of the ESPN. The best food that you've had at the ESPN cafeteria?
Well, this will paint me as quite the earthy, crunchy, vegetarian guy, but I'm really into fitness and eating right, so I like they got a kale salad up there that I really like.
Oh, man, listen to this guy eating his kale. Gotta love it. All right, number five for you, almost to the end here. The favorite player you worked with as an agent, as VP of the Packers, and now as a member of the media?
You know, I think I'm trying to think. Agent and Packers might be the same one, which presented a really unique relationship challenge. I represented Matt Hasselbeck, who, as I mentioned, was a third-string quarterback. Then I took a job with the Packers, and I became, instead of his agent, his, I guess, boss in some ways. Mm-hmm. And we were there together, but we maintained incredible friendship, our wives, close friends, the whole thing. So truly enjoyed working with him. Along with him, I'd just stay with the quarterbacks at the Packers, and I'm not going to favor one or the other. I'm just going to put a tie between Brett Favre and Aaron Rodgers, because each of them, to me, was exactly what a franchise should have. A leader, your best player, your most visible player, who just gets it. He gets that he's the guy that everyone's counting on. He gets that he's the name that drives the product, and neither of them became prima donna, neither of them became too big, and neither of them failed to understand the team concept. So they were good teammates, good friends with everyone. So again, I'm going to put a tie on those two guys.
Works for me. And to imagine what Brett Favre would have been like in his prime had he been on Twitter in the mid to late 90s. Oh boy.
Yes. And in terms of, I know you asked about media. I work with some really interesting guys up at ESPN. It's hard to pick one in terms of former player. I really like working with Teddy Bruschi, Damian Woody, Mark Schlereth, Darren Woodson, just bright guys that work hard and know what their craft is now. You know, it's not playing, it's commentating, and they do a good job on it.
Definitely. I definitely envy you getting to work with some of those guys. That must be pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right, a bonus one for you. Last, before you get out of here, your pick for who's going to be hoisting the Lombardi Trophy at the next Super Bowl in Arizona, here in Glendale, Arizona.
You know, I do have Packer bias from my time there, and I'd have to say I'm going to cop out. I'm going to say it's going to be one of three NFC teams, Packers, 49ers, or Seahawks.
All right. Well, I'm going to go put my money on one of those teams now, and it's on you. All right, Andrew, you survived your Ask Andrew segment. We're going to be looking for those teams to be here in Arizona next year. But now it's your chance to give a quick shout-out, a social media all-star to follow, someone that you recommend people should be following on Twitter, and why.
Well, I put my own, obviously, A.D. Brandt, trying to give unique information about the business of sports, the business of football. As I mentioned, I'm a health nut. I think Sanjay Gupta from CNN Health is really interesting, not only because he talks about diseases and things, but he's a triathlon and talks about getting fit for things like that. As you can see, I'd follow a lot non-sports as well. I think this woman, Meredith Frost, who always puts out these great pictures, she's a photographer, is really interesting. And on the sports side, you know, all the usual suspects, with Adam Schefter having such great information, and Peter King, and always needing to know what's going on in football and sports. And in terms of players, I'm trying to think. You know, I think there's some interesting players out there that I look for that. I look for someone that's interesting, not necessarily a huge name. Mm-hmm. Someone that has stuff that's interesting. No one comes to mind right now, but keep looking. They're out there.
Especially as the season starts getting closer. And you know what? It's really refreshing, interesting to hear that even a superstar, quote unquote, like yourself, still uses Twitter much like a fan does. You get your news from Adam Schefter. You follow a health related account. You follow those cool pictures accounts. I'm really refreshing. And just to remind fans, they can find Andrew on Twitter at AD Brandt. Are there any other places to make sure to look for you on the web? I know you write for mmqb.com website. Any other things where we can find Andrew Brandt online?
Yeah, the mmqb.com was a Sports Illustrated site, and I write a weekly business of football column. And now and then, probably every, I don't know, month or two, I write a little column for the magazine, Sports Illustrated, depending on what issue is. A couple weeks ago, I wrote about this idea of a developmental league in the NFL. Other than that, you can look on Villanova Law School website for a program I'm running about sports law. Called the Morad Center, named after Jeffrey Morad, who's got experience there with the Diamondbacks, was part owner of the San Diego Padres, and has endowed a center at Villanova so we can be a leader in the sports business, sports law area.
Very cool. Some lucky students there, and I hope they never ask you bad questions about how much contracts are actually worth.
No, they're all well-informed.
Well, Andrew, I cannot thank you enough for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure being able to pick your brain a little bit. And it's a great conversation. I know all the listeners will definitely enjoy. So thanks so much again for being on the podcast.
You got it, Neil. Enjoyed it.
Well, thank you so much again to Andrew Brandt for joining us on the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Not just informative, but a real privilege and honor to speak to someone who really has so many demands for their time and is appearing on ESPN to Sports Illustrated, and was able to make time for us here on the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast and discuss some really interesting and emerging and evolving topics in the space. But that'll do it for this episode of the Digital and Social Media Sports Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. And you can find more information on the podcast as well as archive shows at dsmsports.net, and follow me on Twitter for more content at NJH287. Stay tuned for more podcasts to come in the future, and enjoy your summer sports until then, with the World Cup in full swing. MLB getting into the dog days, and well, never a bad time to be a sports fan. We'll see you next time.